From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Speaker Paul Ryan, the GOP debate blimp down, Iran in Syria talks, and a girl thrown down in a South Carolina classroom. GOP debate fireworks in Boulder, Colorado, and a strong showing by Florida Senator Marco Rubio.
My campaign is going to be about the future of America. It's not going to be about attacking anyone else on this stage.
A huge army blimp on the loose over Maryland and Pennsylvania, dragging a line, knocking out power. Here's eyewitness Jason Jerinko.
Here we are, no power, after the blimp has knocked out all the power in Bloomsburg.
And video everywhere of the violent arrest of a high school student near Columbia, South Carolina, a deputy fired, Richland County Sheriff Leon Lott.
He picked the student up and he threw the student across the room. That is not a proper technique and should not be used in law enforcement.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with John Harwood of CNBC. Yes, that John Harwood. Nancy Youssef of the Daily Beast and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you make of the Republican field now of Paul Ryan as Speaker of the House of U.S. Ground Operations in Iraq? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Washington is John Harwood. He's CNBC's chief Washington correspondent, political writer for the New York Times. He was one of CNBC's three moderators in Colorado for the GOP debate. Hot seats for all out there. John Harwood, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tom. Great to be here.
Nancy Youssef is with us from Washington, senior national security correspondent for the Daily Beast. Nancy, welcome back. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, John, and Nancy.
Okay, let's get right into it. Here you were, John, Wednesday night, Republican debate in Boulder, asking Donald Trump his first question of the night.
Mr. Trump.
Yes.
You've done very well in this campaign so far by promising to build a wall and make another country pay for it.
Right.
Send 11 million people out of the country. Cut taxes $10 trillion without increasing the deficit.
Right.
And make Americans better off because your greatness would replace the stupidity and incompetence of others.
That's right.
Let's be honest. Is this a comic book version of a presidential campaign?
It's not a comic book. And it's not a very nicely asked question the way you say that.
Oh, boy. And not so long later, here came back Ted Cruz. Questions being asked tonight illustrate why the American people don't trust the media. Here's Cruz.
This is not a cage match. And you look at the questions. Donald Trump, are you a comic book villain? Ben Carson, can you do math? John Kasich, will you insult two people over here? Marco Rubio, why don't you resign? Jeb Bush, why have your numbers fallen? How about talking about the substantive issues people care about?
John Harwood, there you were. They were on the hot seat. You guys were on the hot seat. What do you make of this angle? And there's more to it, but of this angle of the big debate in Boulder, John.
Well, it was a very smart play by Ted Cruz to come back at us like that. In fact, the question that I posed to Donald Trump and the question that my colleague posed to Ted Cruz were about substantive policy. But look, the media is not popular in the Republican Party. You've got a party that is in turmoil. It's a very fluid race. And the underlying source of the anger and the energy in the party is the same that we felt in that debate is the same thing that's resulted in the speakership of Paul Ryan. It required the resignation of Speaker John Boehner simply to keep the government open and prevent having a debt crisis. That's the nature of this Republican Party. And in this current environment, it's not surprising that they would come back and redirect the heat to us.
Did you go a bridge too far, though, John, in asking Trump if his is a comic book version of a presidential campaign? I mean, I get the tang in that question. Was it too much?
No. Look, there is nobody, including the candidates on that stage. The day before, John Kasich had given a speech, and he said, we've got somebody who is promising to send 10 or 11 million people out of the country. That is just crazy. That is a fantasy. There's no one on that stage who actually believes that you can send those 11 million people out of the country. There is no economist who believes that you can cut taxes $10 trillion without increasing the deficit. It is simply a set of discussions that is not connected to the real world we live in. And I felt and feel at this moment that it's appropriate to oppose that to Donald Trump in that way.
Of course, yes, there was Kasich right out of the blocks. You asked, you know, what's your weakness? And he said, hey, we got to look at who's on this stage and who we might put forward as a Republican candidate. Yes, he had said crazy. He was talking about fantasy here. Here was Kasich opening up on Wednesday night.
Folks, we got to wake up. We cannot elect somebody that doesn't know how to do the job.
But the theme of moderators out of control was one the GOP candidates were very happy to jump on. Chris Christie came back again with you, John, of course. Later on, you're talking about energy. You're interjecting, asking, trying to push him toward a firmer, detailed answer. Here was Chris Christie.
John, do you want me to answer? You want to answer. How are we going to do it? Because I got to tell you the truth, even in New Jersey, what you're doing is called rude.
Jack Beatty, Osage one. Where's the truth here? Rude is CNBC moderators or Republicans sort of not delivering fact-based substantive views? What?
Well, I commend to our readers an article by Amanda Marcotte in Salon. The headline, CNBC did ask substantive questions. That's why Republicans are mad. She goes to the transcript and quotes some of these questions, and they are laden with substance. And now, to point to another problem in this debate, Jeb Bush. I think John asked Jeb Bush the softest, he threw him the softest pitch I have ever seen a reporter talk about an easy question. Bush complained afterwards about gotcha. But this is the question John asked.
Okay.
He said, Ben Bernanke, who was appointed Fed chairman by your brother, recently wrote a book in which he said he no longer considers himself a Republican because the Republican Party has given into know-nothingism. Is that why you're having a difficult time in the race? Oh, man, that's a grand slam home run for any candidate with half a wit who wants to position himself as the, you know, as the winning candidate, as the adult in the room. And feeble Bush bobbled it. He missed it. He swung and missed. So if that's
is he going to stand in front of the GOP and say my party is a bunch of know-nothings? Is he going to do that?
Well, there's a way. Imagine asking a Marco Rubio, somebody with some wit, a question like that. He would turn that all around and say, you know, well, our voters are angry at the establishment, and I feel that too. But you know what? At the end of the day, we want to, et cetera, et cetera. He swung and missed. So
hey,
I think,
Tom,
John.
Yes, John Harwood.
Let me just get in on that. First of all, Jeb Bush actually believes that, what Bernanke said. And he gave a set of remarks over the weekend where he said, what are we doing here in this race? Are we going to sit around and demonize each other and say things that aren't real? He's been thrown off like other establishment Republicans by the rise of people like Donald Trump saying things that I asked Trump about. That was an invitation for him to say things that were on his mind, and he chose not to do it. On the Christie thing, let me just explain what actually happened in that moment. Chris Christie is one of the few people in the Republican Party, among leading candidates, who's willing to say climate change is undeniable, humans contribute to it, and we need to do something about it. So I asked him a simple, straight question about what should we do. He said, well, here's what we shouldn't do. And the reason he did that, and he attacked Hillary Clinton, said she'll raise taxes and expand government spending. The reason he did that was the dynamics in that room are that you don't, if you're a Republican who believes in global warming, you want to talk about that in the general election. You don't want to talk about it in a room of Republican partisans during the primary campaign. So he said, but what we need to do is expand alternative energy. And my comeback to him, which he didn't like, was trying to clarify who is the we. Was he talking about private business or was he talking about government? That's it. And I'm sorry if it's not the role of a moderator to clarify for viewers what the candidate is talking about. I don't know what it is.
Nancy Youssef, let me put you on the hot seat here. There may have been a substance in these questions. Was there something in the delivery? Was there an elite snark in the delivery that gave Republicans an opening to hit back so hard? And they keep hitting back. They're on a roll on this.
Well, you know, I'm not in the political realm, and so I'm watching this, I think, very much as the viewers are. And having watched all three of them, what really strikes me is that we use the word debate to describe what's happening, but there are too many candidates to have an actual debate.
Yeah.
And it seems that zingers are sort of the most effective way to move the discourse, because who's remembering long, detailed answers at this stage in the campaign?
You're a loser if you're giving long, detailed answers,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
That's the way it comes over.
The format and at the time that these debates are happening sort of lends itself to zingers. And so as an outsider, it seems to me it may be worth discussing how many people do you put on that stage who actually have a debate. If you're at 1%, can you still be on the debate? Is there some cutoff point, or is that undemocratic to not let people speak even if it only ends up being zingers?
And yet it's the guy who's around 1%, John Kasich, who's calling out, he says, some fantasy factors. Nancy in Proctor, Vermont, is calling. Nancy, hi, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that they call this the media. It is the liberal media, which is clearly and evidently biased and hostile towards the Republicans, and it was very clear during this debate.
What do you make then of John Kasich, Nancy? He's saying, look, guys, we're talking some crazy stuff up here and we got to stop it. And he's calling out Republicans and saying, let's get serious. Is he liberal too, John Kasich?
John Kasich is not a true conservative Republican, I don't believe.
Nancy, I got it. I mean, John, there it comes back. The mainstream media is too liberal. You heard Marco Rubio say from that stage, that's the Democrats' super PAC, the mainstream media.
Tom, remember, the people like our caller are ones who sacked Speaker Boehner, who believe that you saw a tremendous amount of agitation as Paul Ryan, who is one of the most strict fiscal conservatives in national politics. When he was about to take the speakership and was being put forward, you had a campaign saying he was too liberal. That's just the nature of the Republican base at the moment. And, you know, if they don't like questions about the policies that are being discussed, you know, that's a problem for them. And if they want to come back and say liberal media, that's fine. That everybody's got a prerogative to speak.
Would you take it back, John? A question, a word, a wink, anything from that moderation?
Yes, I would. But, you know, now's not the time to review that. I got to go back and look at the tape. I haven't seen it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Brand new speaker, Paul Ryan, the GOP debate in Colorado, the blimp down, and all the rest. You can join us this hour. How did you see the GOP debate, the contenders, the questioners, the bottom line, who's rising, who should quit? Is the U.S. in combat again in Iraq or not? Can you figure it out? And can we talk our way to a solution over Syria? What do you expect from new House Speaker Paul Ryan? What do you make of that blimp? What do you make of that whole scene in the South Carolina classroom? Nancy Youssef is with us, senior national security correspondent for the Daily Beast. John Harwood is here, back from Colorado in his moderation role there for CNBC. Jack Beatty's here. Bill is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. I've heard this GOP chorus and song before, and I'm old enough to remember, as I hope some of you are. There were two GOP leaders who talked endlessly about how they were being misrepresented in the news and the liberal media and the bias. And both of them wound up being felons, and that was Richard Nixon and Spiro Agnew, one of the most vociferous critics of the press. And I think it's just an old, tired tactic, and they're just rolling it out again.
I mean, but does so it's been used before, so it's a tactic that works. Biggest applause of the night, some of the biggest applausometer readings in history for Ted Cruz there. But does that mean there's no truth in it, Bill?
I think there is no truth in it. And, I think the free press is irritates politicians of all stripes, but it seems to irritate the Republicans more. They seem to be more vulnerable to truthful reporting.
Bill, we've got it. One more right here. Claire in Madison, Wisconsin. Claire, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Tom. I commend Mr. Harwood and his colleagues for asking the tough questions. If you're going to run for president, you're going to get tough questions. But it's so interesting to compare this to the week before when Hillary Clinton was grilled for 11 hours. And these people are whining about a five-minute, three-minute, one-minute confrontation.
Well, fair enough, though you heard Marco Rubio complain about exactly that, Claire. He said, look, Hillary Clinton went through all this, and the press said, best week of a year. He portrayed that as a kind of press whitewash as well.
Well, they have to ask the questions about the policies, and if the candidate can't handle the answers, then there's something wrong there.
Claire, I appreciate your call. Jack, give us a little wisdom here. I mean, the heat over this, yes, it may be partly tactics on that stage. People can work the ref or, you know, try and cow the moderators. But there's been a huge response to it in the hall and beyond in Republican circles. I mean, do we have a problem here that now extends to our very public discourse about what is going on, even what's factual?
Well, I do think this whole business of what's factual is in debate. I mean, a few years ago,
is it? Can Donald Trump really deport 11 million people?
No, he cannot.
He cannot. No, but there's a kind of faith-based politics out there too, you know, and where ideology is what matters first of all. Statements aren't tested for how veridical they are, how they match up against reality, but how consistent they are with previous views, with a established opinion, and that is a particular turn of mind of Republican conservatives. How does this fit with the conservative worldview? And if you ask a question that say, alludes to the world, to reality, and that isn't answered in the conservative worldview, it looks like bias, when really it's a kind of reality testing. And so I do think there's a problem, but I think the problem is as much with this Republican fixation on ideology over you know, grappling with the real facts, climate change, deficits, all the rest, than it is some sort of bias in the media.
I mean, I can hear Republicans swallowing their tongues saying they're not dealing with deficits. Many said that's what they wanted to do this week. Some still not happy with the new plan that came out. But then in the debate in Boulder, your colleague, John Harwood, Becky Quick, going to Ben Carson and saying your tithing idea, 10% or 15% flat tax would leave a giant hole of, a trillion and a half or a trillion? He just said, not true. I'd make cuts. Who's got the facts there? Can she know what he's planning, John?
Well, he hasn't really spelled out what he's planning. You heard in his response that his initial musing about tax reform was, well, I'll base it off of tithing, which is the 10%. The idea of giving 10% of your income. And what he said there was, in his response was, well, it'll be closer to 15%. And then he started suggesting that it would be 15% of our entire economy. And it's not clear what he meant by that. He doesn't actually have a tax plan that he's laid out. But if you put everybody's tax rate, if you take our current tax system and put everybody's tax rate at 10%, it's pretty clear you're not going to raise enough money to fund the government as it exists currently.
We had a great conversation on all the substance of that debate yesterday. If you missed it, check it out online. One more piece I've got to look at here with you all. Jeb Bush, he went after Marco Rubio in that debate, seemed to like it was a swing and a miss. And now people asking questions about his campaign. Here he was going after Rubio's attendance record at the Boulder, Colorado GOP debate.
Marco, when you signed up for this, this was a six-year term, and you should be showing up to work. I mean, literally, the Senate, what is it, like a French work week? You get like 3 days where you have to show up? You can campaign or just resign and let someone else take the job.
John Harwood, is he still in there? A lot of heat on Jeb Bush this week.
Anybody who's got $100 million is still in the game. But Jeb Bush has got a big problem, which is that he's not polling well. He is not inspiring confidence in Republicans, and which is what led to his musing the weekend before the debate when he said, "If I'm just going to sit around and get demonized and be compelled to demonize others, I've got better things to do." That doesn't sound like somebody who is in it to win it, and so he needs to try to
portray, convince Republicans that he is and that he has got a way of appealing to them. And that was not a good exchange for him. Marco Rubio, his former protege in Florida, came back at him very strongly and effectively. And now that's something he's got to deal with.
We got a lot of issues here. Nancy Youssef, I want to ask you about American troops and Iraq and whether we are now in combat again. Ash Carter, defense secretary, before the Senate Armed Services Committee on Tuesday, here he was saying the U.S. will step up action, airstrikes, and more. Here's Carter.
We won't hold back from supporting capable partners in opportunistic attacks against ISIL or conducting such missions directly, whether by strikes from the air or direct action on the ground.
Nancy, what exactly is going on? Over the summer, the president said no combat role. Now, this week, what is Ash Carter saying? What are we doing? Are we back boots on the ground in combat in Iraq?
This is a game of messaging that is happening because this administration has been adamant that it is the one that got the U.S. out of Iraq, not back in it. And now you have 3,000 troops based there and the first combat death, undeniably, Master Sergeant Wheeler, who was killed in a raid rescuing 70 ISIS prisoners. And so all of a sudden this came to the forefront. What is being asked of U.S. troops in this war? And it becomes so important because what the administration is trying to argue is that it is committed to defeating and degrading ISIS and yet is hesitant to say that it will do it by means of combat. So there's a contradiction there. If you're committed to defeating ISIS, don't you have to do it with combat? Remember that when the president started the ISIS campaign, he said that the Americans would not be dying, that they would not be in combat. But there has been a slow escalation of the U.S. involvement, first as trainees and now going out on raids like this. And so this was a very Washington game of trying to play with language. But it becomes important because the languaging affects the execution of the war fighting. And so the concession by the defense secretary later this week that they are in combat, certainly in air combat, it's in the name of the strike, combat airstrikes, is important because it gets closer to acknowledging what the U.S. is doing and how it will go about trying to defeat this terror group.
But what was the message from Defense Secretary Carter this week? Was he saying we're going to be doing more of this? Were we effectively going back on the ground in Iraq? I mean, it's getting weird. You've reported on how we've got casualties there already.
Yeah.
And the Pentagon is refusing to say who they were or when they were injured or how they were injured. I mean, this is kind of like Russia in Ukraine or something.
Well, it's the latest iteration of combat. So the language that they're using is that there will be combat activity, but this is not the traditional combat of sort of holding and taking territory. So, for example, rather than going and taking Fallujah, this will be going house to house. And in the case of the raid on the prison, it'll be building to building. That they're arguing that it is not a sustained combat role because you don't have thousands of troops on the ground leading the front lines, but that there will be combat missions, but this doesn't make it an overall combat war. Now, if you say that to somebody who has worn the uniform, many take offense to it because for them, if you put them in harm's way, if you arm them, if you're giving them hazardous duty pay, if you're giving them live ammunition, they are in combat. And that combat is not something you can come in and out of. That state of combat readiness is enduring for the duration of their service.
If you're a soldier,
overseas.
It looks like combat. Here was the president earlier this year asking for authorization from Congress to broaden the fight against ISIS.
The resolution we've submitted today does not call for the deployment of U.S. ground combat forces to Iraq or Syria. It is not the authorization of another ground war like Afghanistan or Iraq.
Okay, John Harwood, where are we going here? Is the administration playing this straight with the American people?
Well, I think so, but I think we don't know where we're going. He plainly doesn't want to be involved in a ground war, but he also doesn't want to leave a catastrophic mess to his successor. So it's a tough moment for the president that pits his own strong inclinations with his view of reality on the ground, and I think it's destination unknown.
Jack Beatty, transparency here with Americans about what's going on?
Well, you know, certainly obliquity, let's put it that way. We hear one thing and then we hear another. But it does seem to me that this terrible Sergeant Wheeler's death, that was implicit all along in the in this policy of we will be aiding the Iraqis, and that means we're going to go increasingly forward. Now, there was a report this week that, in a way, I think was ominous for future U.S. involvement, because there's some talk about integrating our people forward even more so they can act as spotters for our aircraft, for the bombing. Well, in Iran this week, there was a report that several senior officers have been killed doing just that for the Russian bombing. So that's a portent. More of that could happen and to happen to the Americans.
We've got to turn to the House of Representatives. Paul Ryan, against his will, or at least his long holdout this week, he's made Speaker of the House. Won that election on Thursday, told the chamber he would fix the broken House of Representatives.
The House is broken. We're not solving problems. We're adding to them. And I am not interested in laying blame. We are not settling scores. We are wiping the slate clean.
John Harwood, can Paul Ryan do it? Can he wipe the slate clean?
No, but he's got a big advantage, which is that John Boehner did a tremendous favor to him by handing him a speakership in which he is not going to have a debt crisis for the first year and a half of his speakership. He is not going to have a budget issue for the first 2 years of his speakership. So he doesn't really have to do very much. But the underlying problem, I think the hope for Paul Ryan is that the fever passes within the Republican Party. Remember, all that John Boehner was trying to do was raise the debt limit and get the basics of a budget through the Congress so as not to have a crisis for the party, crisis for the economy. It is very difficult to do in a party that has a lot of undifferentiated anger that isn't actually connected to a policy agenda. You know, when you – Ted Cruz was asked by my colleague Chuck Todd before about a week and a half ago, what do you want in return for raising the debt limit? And he said, I want the party to fight. And Chuck said, fight for what? And he said, anything. That's the point. There is not after the budget cutting that's been done over the last couple of years, mainstream Republicans in Congress know that there's not much more to do on the domestic or defense side of the budget. That's why they've agreed to this deal that raised the sequester caps. Mm-hmm. They don't believe in those caps anymore. The problem is the money, aside from those, is in Medicare and Social Security. Well, that's not very popular to cut. They don't want to go there. You do not have active proposals to right now cut spending on Medicare and Social Security because they're politically unpopular.
But we heard Rand Paul say, John, the other night, forgive me to be New Jersey rude, but he was saying we've got a fiscal, as he always does, we've got a fiscal crisis. Now, so do we have one or not?
No, we don't. I mean, we have a long-term deficit in the country. Our budget deficit has come down substantially. It's now less than 3% of the size of our economy. That is not a crisis. However, Medicare and Social Security in particular are long-term budget burdens as us baby boomers begin to retire. So that's where the cuts have to take place. But politicians don't want to make them, including Republican politicians in the Congress. And so there's a problem. They know it. There's a theoretical commitment within the Republican Party to cut spending. But that desire has no place to go right now. And that's why you have this, as I said, this sort of undifferentiated resistance that John Boehner dealt with by quitting.
Jack Beatty, what's it all mean for the 2016 campaign, this budget deal? Big deal. Deep into 2017 here, we won't have that sword hanging over the Congress, the country, for much longer time than we're used to lately.
Well, you know, Tom, the deal boosts spending by $80 billion over those 2 years, and that would result in an extra 500,000 jobs, according to the Council of economic advisors. Now, that's a modest stimulus. It'll help Hillary Clinton, and she needs help. History suggests she has an uphill climb. For only once since 1945 have voters given the same party three terms. You know, peer with me into a crystal ball that's forecast the winner in all seven elections since 1988, the last time a party won three terms. Political scientist Alan Abramovitz, his model uses three variables, the incumbent's approval rating, economic growth in the second quarter, and the number of terms the incumbent party has held the White House. The model predicts that for Clinton to get 50% of the vote, President Obama's approval rating needs to rise 5 points and economic growth to hit 3.5%. She needs a much bigger stimulus than this budget deal to get to 3.5%.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, four dead, nearly 50 others injured when a 25-year-old woman plowed her car into an Oklahoma State University homecoming parade last weekend. She's undergoing psychological evaluation.
I turned and I knew what was going to happen. She sped up and gunned it and ran right into the crowd.
A World Health Organization report links the consumption of processed meats to cancer. Late show host Stephen Colbert went to town on that.
Smoked meats are as dangerous as asbestos? Well, there goes my plan to insulate my attic with jerky. How can cured meat be bad for you? It's got the word cure right in the name.
And film legend Maureen O'Hara, Hollywood actress best known for starring in Miracle on 34th Street and The Quiet Man, died at 95. Here she was in 1952 in The Quiet Man with John Wayne.
The bold one you are. And who gave you leave to be kissing me?
So you can talk.
Yes, I can, I will, and I do. It's more than talk you'll be getting if you step a step closer to me.
Ah, boy. Those were the days. We're looking at a week in the news. Speaker Paul Ryan, the GOP debate blimped down. Iran joins Syria talks. Girl down in a South Carolina classroom. Nancy Youssef is with us, senior national security correspondent for the Daily Beast. John Harwood is here, CNBC's chief Washington correspondent, political writer for the New York Times. Jack Beatty is here. You can join us. What did we see in that South Carolina classroom video? The girl and the deputy and the violence and subsequently the firing? Is the U.S. right to challenge China in the South China Sea? Can you remember when China didn't have a one-child policy? That's changed this week. And what are you thinking on? Bacon, baloney, the runaway blimp. We'll get right to South Carolina. But, Nancy, I want to ask you about that U.S. Guided missile destroyer sailed within 12 nautical miles of Subi Reef. This is one of these artificial islands China's built in the South China Sea. I got a little tape here of the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, saying, hey, don't be reckless. He said, don't take reckless action, USA. Here he is, here's a China Central Television news anchor. So this is what the Chinese are hearing. In response to the unusual occurrence of an American warship entering waters within 12 nautical miles of Chinese islands in the South China Sea, Wang Yi, the foreign minister, said China was still trying to verify the situation and that if reports are true, we advise the United States to think carefully before acting. Nancy, what's going on here?
Well, basically, after President Xi's visit to the United States in which this issue came up, the Chinese insistence that the South China Sea as part of their territory. It seems the United States gave China some time to stop construction, and in fact, that did not happen. And so the deployment of the USS Larsen patrol through the South China Sea in that part that you mentioned was a sense of a message to China that we consider this international waters. And that has two sort of goals in mind. One is to say that this is an issue of freedom of navigation. And this is also a trade and economic issue, that if China continues to treat that area as part of its territory and assert itself as such, it has great, great costs, particularly to countries like China, through which most of their natural gas and oil go through. And the U.S. is trying to send a message that the freedom of navigation will be respected. The question becomes, how do you sustain that message? Does the United States have to keep doing it? And while the Chinese language has been very bellicose this week in response, it's not clear what their response would be, practically speaking, given the size of the U.S. Navy fleet compared to China's. And so,
and what are their options, Nancy? That language seemed to be saying, "Hey, you do this again, and we're telling you we might just hit your ship."
Well, one option would be, for example, putting fishing vessels in front and their Coast Guard behind. And by doing so, if the United States were to bump one of those fishing vessels or kill Chinese ship mates there, that you would have an escalation of sorts, that you have the Coast Guard behind. But that's just one option. But it becomes a sort of potential of slow escalation. Again, if the United States does it again, if it does not, will China stop construction? And so we're now at this point where we have to see who's going to move and how. I know the language is very bellicose, but the question now becomes in actions. Will they continue to develop those reefs? Will they continue to move? Remember that for the allies, the U.S. allies in the region, Vietnam and the Philippines in particular, this is quite jarring because they don't have the naval capability to defend that. And again, it is so critical to trade operations in the region. Mm-hmm. And so we're now at a point where we kind of have to see who blinks first and how.
High stakes there. Also in Vienna right now, where there's conversations going on, including Iran this time, and of course, Russia now, over the future of Syria. But I want to go to South Carolina first, if we can, and that video that was just been wall-to-wall over the country this week of the deputy in the classroom, a schoolgirl in high school would not surrender her cell phone, during class, and he ends up flipping her violently out of her chair. All kinds of uproar from lots of directions over that. He ends up being fired on Tuesday. This was Columbia County Assistant School Superintendent Penny Jackson telling NBC 26 that police officers at schools are not there to discipline students but to keep the peace.
Our training is such that our officers know not to behave in such a way that would be that way to a student.
Well, maybe, but we all saw on the video at least that piece of it, and now Ben Fields, the deputy, is fired. The explanation for that? Interesting. Here, this was the county sheriff, Richland County Sheriff Leon Lott, announcing that firing for his actions during the classroom arrest of a Spring Valley High School student.
He was not trained to throw the student. When you make an arrest from someone who does not have a weapon that you need to escape from, you never let go of that subject. You maintain control of him, the person you're trying to arrest. When he threw her across the room, he lost control of her. That's not acceptable. That's what violated our policy.
So I'm not sure what to make of that. If he just held on to her and shaken her up and down but not let go, it would be all right. Nia Kenny filmed that arrest. Some of the video that has come out of her classmate there, she was arrested and charged with disturbing school following the whole altercation, released on a $1,000 bond.
I know this girl don't got nobody, and I couldn't believe this was happening. I'd never seen nothing like that in my life. Like, a man used that much force on a little girl, a big man, like 300 pounds, a full muscle. I was like, no way, no way. Like, you can't do that to no little girl. I'm talking about she like 5'6".
Of course, it turns out later we learn that she's recently been orphaned, that she's a foster kid now, but big national conversation about what was the right thing here. A lot of outrage over what was seen there. Let's get our callers in, and I'll come to you, John, Nancy, Jack, Randy in Nebraska City, Nebraska. Randy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call, and thanks so much for your segue. What did we see? Because I think a more important question is, what didn't we see? And you did not see a teacher trying to maintain order in the classroom and having an atmosphere that was conducive to learning by asking that student to behave. You didn't see that teacher finally give up and call in a resource officer who asked her several times politely to quit doing that, come with me. And student not only did not comply with that, but actually struck the officer.
Are you sure? Are you sure about that?
That's the report I heard.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've in the part of the video that I've seen, I didn't see that. But let me ask you, was this guy right? You saw when she's flipped on her head. That was violent. That was violent. No question about it. Is that right?
What you said was you didn't see that. And that's the unfortunate part. We didn't see what led up to the incident.
She's a girl in a high school class. Is a policeman right to take that level of violence against her? She's not armed. She's not threatening him in a serious way? You think so? You think
he
is?
She, She had her chance with the teacher to quit doing what she was doing. She had her chance with the teacher to leave the room and go to the office.
Yeah, I got that. I guess the question here, Randy, is whether we're going to escalate police behavior in school classrooms up to this level of violence and say, that's okay, when there's not a weapon, there's not a life and death situation going on. But I take your point. She had her choice. She had a chance. But even so, Sharon in Janesville, Wisconsin. Janesville, home of Paul Ryan, I think. Hi, Sharon. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think that officer could have easily pulled that chair right out of the classroom. If he would have, she was hanging onto that chair with all her might. He could have just
take the whole thing.
Take the whole thing and take it right out into the hall. But he wanted to demonstrate, I think, to the other students what he could do if they don't behave. He definitely was putting on a show in my mind, and I think he was wrong.
He demonstrated all right, and now she's at one more, and I'll come to my panel, Jovan in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jovan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have one comment I wanted to make, and it's kind of simple. To me, we're trying to get somewhere, but we're using cars that were made in the 17th century. In order to travel, we're going to need updated laws. We're going to need some reform because, to me, I think it will bring world peace because we're divided people. But when you look at it, we're all human. I could look at you. I'm what you would consider African American.
Okay.
But I could look at you in your face and tell you, we're still family.
I get that. But what should have happened in that classroom, Jovan? She was asked to give up her phone. She wouldn't. But was the officer right to flip her on her head?
No, sir. I wouldn't think that would be right. What I would think would be more of get the class away from her, let someone come in and talk to her, maybe get the class to a gym or something, and let other officers come in and talk to her, see what the problem is. That would be more of the proper way to deal with it.
Yeah, Jovan, I appreciate your call. John Harwood, what did you see in the video? What do you see in this situation?
Well, it's pretty clear that the right thing to do was not for him to violently go after the student. As for what the right thing to do would have been, I don't really know. I think dealing with controlling high school kids in certain situations is a pretty tough job. And, you know, the teacher tried and failed. The resource officer tried and failed. What is the step beyond that? I don't know, but it wasn't to knock the student to the floor and in a violent way like that.
Jack, we're getting into this situation where we're seeing more and more reports of police, very active, sometimes tasers out in high schools doing what we used to just think of as school discipline.
Tom, just in the last 3 months alone, an officer in Texas put a student in a chokehold to stop a fight. An officer in Rhode Island slammed a student to the floor. And in Kentucky, a school district is being sued for shackling 8- and 9-year-olds. Kids as young as 4 in Texas have been issued tickets for misbehavior. 19 states, South Carolina is one of them, still inflict corporal punishment on children. And these zero-tolerance policies, you know, you misbehave, you're thrown out, they've been especially harsh toward minorities. According to one study, black students make up 18% of school enrollees, but are 35% of those suspended and 39% of those expelled. Overall, blacks are 3.5 times more likely to be thrown out of school than whites.
That looks like a problem right there. Also, you've got teachers saying we've got discipline problems. We don't know what to do. King in Atlanta, Georgia. King, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to echo that point. I think the deeper issue is how African-American children are seen and if they are actually seen as children, whether we're talking about this girl in South Carolina or mm-hmm. Trayvon Martin or any of these children that are involved in these police incidents. If you're in a high school and there's a high school counselor, presumably, why would you not call a counselor before you call the police when it's a known fact that this girl is an orphan? Even though the girl in the video says, you know, this girl has no one. So apparently it's known at least by the students what's going on in this young girl's life and that she might actually be acting out.
Yeah.
And so my major point is, why is our first instinct with African-American children discipline and police and not counseling and understanding that there may be some
sociological or psychological issue going on with them.
King, I appreciate your call. We're not going to solve that one here today, but that's a big question sitting on the country's plate right now. Nancy Youssef, I've got to ask you about this huge blimp that we saw floating all over the place, 100-plus miles over Maryland and Pennsylvania, came down about 80 miles north of Harrisburg. Here's just a little description of that scene as this giant white blimp came down.
I came up the road here, and next thing I saw the state police and news vehicles parked in the church driveway, and I was like, whoa, something's going on. And I found out it was right behind our house, probably about 300 yards, half a mile away in the little hollow down below.
Nancy, what was that thing? Supposed to be defending the Capitol or what, from cruise missiles? If it's such a big deal, so important, billions spent on developing this, how could it just float off?
Nobody knows, but it made for a very interesting day at the Pentagon when you've got Pentagon officials scrambling to find a blimp flying over the United States. This blimp,
putting fighter jets up and all the rest.
That two F-16 fighter jets that were armed. So we had armed aircraft flying over the United States over a blimp that, ironically enough, was designed, as you note, for billions of dollars to defend the United States. It's called an aerostat, and it has these radars on it. It was initially designed to detect cruise missiles and can detect anything, and it was this three-year experiment. It had all these cables that was holding it together or to the ground, and somehow it just came up and went and was afloat, and the cables were taking out power in the communities as this blimp came.
It's a 6,000-foot cable. It's
right.
A serious
That's
thing.
That's right. Well, it was 6,000 feet in the air when it was at Aberdeen Proving Ground, where it escaped, if you will, and to see it flying over Amish country, over schools, slowly deflating, doing damage, and the United States military scrambling to chase a blimp was rather amusing. But the costs are real, and there were smaller versions of these blimps in Iraq and Afghanistan. I saw them there all the time, and they would frequently become untethered, and troops had to shoot them at times. And so this has been a systemic problem with these aerostats.
Americans get a little piece of that experience. I got to ask you, we just got half a minute, sitting down to talk Syria in Vienna. John Kerry sounds hopeful. Why?
Because John Kerry is an eternal optimist. There is one very hopeful thing that comes out of it, is that you have two very serious foes, Saudi Arabia and Iran, in the same room. And that in and of itself is a victory. Does it lead to a negotiated settlement? We're very far away from that.
That just getting up on the rails. We will watch those talks. Iran now involved, Russia now involved, and as Nancy Youssef says, Saudi Arabia there as well. Maybe something coming out of that. Nancy Youssef, Senior National Security Correspondent for The Daily Beast. It's always great to have you with us, Nancy, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
John Harwood, CNBC's Chief Washington Correspondent, survives the week. John, thank you for coming in and being with us. Always great to have you here.
You bet.
And Jack Beatty, wonderful as always to have you, sir. Have a great autumn week then, a weekend up there in your New Hampshire splendor.
Peak color, Tom. Thank you.
Peak color. That's our Jack. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.